Just hit it harder. Sorry.
Good afternoon. The House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development will come to order. We will start with an informational meeting on Connect Oregon. And Jerry's here somewhere. Please come on up and reacquaint us with a program I think many of us are pretty fond of.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, committee members. For the record, my name is Jerry Bohart. I'm the interim deputy director for operations with the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I'm here just to give you a brief overview of the Connect Oregon program. First, I just want to acquaint you with what's in your packet. I'll just summarize a little bit of the testimony that's been provided to you. But you also have two things just kind of as a visual. A map. I think you've all seen a variety of different maps, but this map really highlights all of the projects through the Connect 1, Connect 2, and Connect 3 programs. And the colored dots actually just reflect the different programs, whether it's the first, second, or third program. And then the other one, I'm not going to go through this PowerPoint, but I thought it would just be helpful for you to, we highlighted about, I think there's 14 projects in here that I think really exemplify the projects that we wanted to see come out of the Connect Oregon program. So a few pictures and just a few synopsis of it. So just for some additional reading, because I know you all don't have enough to read. So I think maybe just a little bit of a history. Back in 2005, the Oregon legislature created the Multimodal Transportation Fund. And this was really for the purposes of investing in non-highway projects. So we're talking about aviation, rail, transit, and marine. And it became known as the Connect Oregon program, providing both grants and loans to non-highway transportation projects. In each of the three past biennium, $100 million of lottery-backed funds have been allocated for this program. And ultimately, it's the Transportation Commission that selects the projects. I think as we were going through the Connect One program, it was the recognition that local governments and businesses often lack the sufficient capital and technical capacity to undertake multimodal transportation projects. And that with public assistance, we could see long-term economic growth and job creation out of these non-highway projects. And so out of the $300 million that's been already allocated through the Connect Oregon program, we've seen 171 projects selected, and that was out of 327 that were eligible. And the leverage of the $300 million has been close to $680 million. One thing I would note in that is that certainly in the Connect 3 program, one of the last things was $5 million that was set aside for rural airports. And those actually led to 57 projects. But the other thing that it led to was leveraging of $65 million from the Federal Aviation Administration. So just a little bit of background with regards to the process. In Connect 1, we had four modal committees that helped review the projects and provided assistance to our commission, and that was the Freight Advisory Committee, the State Aviation Board, our Rail Advisory Committee, and then our Public Transit Committee. They really looked at what we call six considerations that were found in the bill. Connect 2 and Connect 3 are very similar to that process. We actually added on a fifth modal committee out of Oregon Business, the marine component through their ports. And then we also just did some fine-tuning to the considerations to really deal with job creation and how we look at connecting modes when we're looking at the applications. I would say that we really try to fast-track this process, more so in Connect 2 and Connect 3 than in Connect 1. Any new program always has a little bit of hiccups as you go along. But through Connect 2 and Connect 3, we had the rules ready to go based on the legislation. We had the guidance documents that we had learned from Connect 1, our applications we had made some changes to, and we really were able to move very quickly once the bill was signed. I would note, however, with working with five modal committees and five regional committees, it does take a little time to get through the process, but it certainly provided for better project selection and obviously transparency of the process. I think one thing that was truly unique about the process was the final review committee. And I've really only been involved in the Connect 2 and Connect 3 programs. But the final review committee, we bring forward representatives from our five modal committees as well as our five regional committees. And they really work and look at all of the information that's been provided through the process. And I think it was fair to say that in both processes, there was complete agreement on the top third of the projects that should be selected and the bottom third of the projects that, if money allowed, maybe should have been selected but weren't under consideration. And then they really worked through the middle part and made sure they had regional equity and really understood the projects there. On page 3 of my testimony, I won't go into the numbers, but what I've done is provide you with two tables that really shows the applications that were submitted through each of the programs by mode, and then ultimately the applications that were awarded by mode and by program. And I think the one thing that I would note on each of these is that for every dollar that was funded, there was a request for over $2. So you can see there was really a doubling of requests through each of the processes. From a status standpoint, the Connect One program is essentially done. We have 90% of the projects are complete and the rest are under construction. We also, when we went through the application process, did ask the applicants to identify, in the case of Connect One, jobs that would be created by construction and then those they thought that would be permanent. And you can see in the testimony where, based on their information, you'd see a little over 1,800 construction jobs and a little over 7,000 permanent jobs. We did a little bit more work through the application process in Connect 2, and you can see where they talked about creating or retaining a little over 7,000 jobs. We didn't ask them to estimate their construction jobs there. And in the case of Connect 2, we're just a little bit halfway through the program with 16 of the projects being completed. Connect 3 was just approved by the commission back in August. All of the projects are under agreement with the local governments or the railroad or whoever is the applicant. We do have one project that's actually complete. And in the case of the rural airports, 9 of the projects have been completed and the remainder are under construction. So, in summary, the Connect Oregon program is a vital program for non-highway projects across the state, resulting in improved infrastructure and the creation and retention of jobs critical for Oregonians. Connect Oregon has proven to be a valuable and successful program that is good for Oregon's economy and for all Oregonians. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions, and I also have additional testimony specific to House Bill 2166. Thank you
very much. Let's start with if there are any general questions about the program as a whole, and then we'll get right to that bill. And I know that we have a robust list of people who want to testify on the bill. Any general questions?
You want to hear me? Thank you.
Mr.
Chair.
Indicating maybe.
Yeah, I'm trying to decide if I want to ask this question or not, but that's okay. We did build in a regional approach to this project, and I guess my question would be, do you feel that that's necessary to make sure the projects are spread out, or do you think it's a detriment to selecting bigger the better projects, I guess? Not bigger, but better projects?
And maybe I could add to that question a little bit. Does your answer to that question change depending on the amount of the total program?
Sure.
Co-Chair Reed, Representative Beyer. I think in the Connect 1, 2, and 3 program, it was very beneficial to have the regional equity. I think it certainly laid a foundation for the discussion, and there was certainly sufficient funds to also look at some of the bigger projects from a statewide perspective. One of the key messages as we went through the program was that we really were looking at statewide projects that we wanted them to benefit the state, connect modes, And that some of them, you know, from regional equity, happen to be located in each of the five regions, was just an additional benefit. So I think that those two meshed really well by having, and I think, you know, Connect 1 had a 15%, and Connect 2 and Connect 3, they reduced that down to 10%. I think that was actually the right number. So it laid a good foundation for our modal committees and our area commissions on transportation to work together, but then really provided the funding to look at some of the larger projects. I do think it is a little bit trickier with the Dash 1 amendments that are being proposed at $40 million, but I think it can still work. I think it's a process that we're all comfortable with having the regional equity, and then the remainder going for statewide. And so I think our regions, and I think our modes are used to that conversation. And for that reason, I think continuing with a similar process would probably be of the best way to go.
Thank you.
Any follow-ups?
No.
Okay. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the year to talk about jobs. There have been statements in your testimony and also in our memo about how many jobs are estimated to be created through construction, whether we're talking about something new or repair, upgrade, maintenance, all of that. How many jobs are related directly to the project itself, and then how many permanent jobs would be created? Now, I want to preface my statement with this is not meant to be critical. I even have my own proposals about how I think we ought to invest in infrastructure because I think it creates a permanent enhancement to Oregon's economy. So given that, however, when I see the number of jobs that are mentioned in here, permanent jobs, I wonder if you could explain to me the analysis that went behind that, because sometimes when you talk about jobs, you're just moving around pieces of the pie. Well, the job used to be doing this, now it's doing that. What's the analysis that demonstrates how these are truly additional jobs and not just moved around from somewhere else?
Co-Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson. The numbers that are here are a little bit difficult to analyze. The numbers did come from the applicant. So, and each of them obviously probably had a little bit different methodology about how they were looking at their numbers. One of the things that we did, particularly in the Connect 2 and the Connect 3 program, was working with our economists at ODOT. We have a number of economists at ODOT, and then working with Business Oregon. We actually did ask them to evaluate the reasonableness of the numbers that were being presented by the applicants. And when we when staff then scored the projects, they ranked it based on that information. So, for instance, if they felt that the numbers were and the economic benefit that was being provided to the state, I don't know if I remember the scoring correctly, but they would give them a 5, and then it kind of ranged from 1 to 5. So that was the best that we were able to do. It was actually a question that came up with our commission under the Connect 3 program, where they want to try to get a better sense of truthing the numbers that come forward out of the projects. And so we have put in as one of the reporting mechanisms for Connect 3 is to identify the number of jobs that are either created or retained as part of the program. Again, it still is self-reporting, so it will have its limitations.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One brief follow-up. Can you tell me whether it's possible that a project needed desperately for a safety enhancement, whether that would be disfavored relative to other projects because it didn't create any additional permanent jobs?
Chair Reed, Representative Nathanson, trying to think through some of the projects. I don't think there are 6 considerations that get looked at as part of the bill. The economic benefit that it brings to the state, the project readiness. So it gets scored across all of those. So economic benefit is just one part of the analysis. And I think that is probably where working with the modes and the regions, it becomes really important. It was actually a project, it was an airport project in Eastern Oregon, and it really was about fire prevention in order to maintain this aviation facility. And that did rank high and was funded. So there are examples, I think, of all of those in there.
Thank you.
Thank you. And does perhaps you could refresh at least my memory, maybe the others are all perfect, on the sort of maybe its parallel nature sort of as the regional and modal committees and how those come together?
Okay. Co-Chair Reed, in the Connect 2 and the Connect 3 process, so we kind of morphed it a little bit from the Connect 1 process. So we had the modal committees review all of the projects, and the other than the Freight Advisory Committee, and the Freight Advisory Committee actually looks across modes at all of the freight projects, so whether it was aviation or marine or whatnot, they were looking at the freight component. They all prioritize and score them and give them a high, medium, and low. And this information is then provided to the regions. And there's actually kind of a one-page summary associated with each of the projects. So it explains kind of the scoring and the rationale that they gave to it. And that information is then provided to the modes as they go through their review. I think one of the things it's fair to say that we heard through the final review committee was they wanted to see a stronger connection, perhaps, between that. It's a lot of paper for everybody to read. And that was, I think, one of the lessons learned that came out of Connect 3. I think what we're trying to figure out, depending on what this program looks like, most likely trying to get the modes to attend our area commission meetings and bring the information and the rationale for how they prioritize the way that they did.
Thank you. I'm going to excuse myself for just a moment. One of my bills is up for a hearing across the way, so I'll be back in just a moment. Good. Co-chair will take over.
President Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, would you happen to know, and you may have to get this to me offline, what your current debt service is on these projects with the bonding that you have done and what it is relative to the overall fund?
Co-Chair Bentz and Representative Widener, I will have to get that to you offline. I don't know exactly the status of where we are in our bonding. So.
Other questions? I have one. The mix between public and private is of interest on these kind of projects. Is the return to the state for its investment in a public-private business just the additional jobs, or is there some sort of retained interest? I know there isn't, but should there be, other than just the hope that everything is better from the economic standpoint? I ask this because this conversation is ongoing in the tax credit discussions we're having, where some have suggested that when the state makes this investment, it should have greater return than merely the jobs.
Co-Chair Bentz, if I understand your question correctly, first of all, with the Connect program, there's a 20% match by the applicant, so you can see that many of them did more than the minimum 20% match. Also, in the agreements that we put together, the projects have to have at least a 20-year life to them. So we are looking at that kind of continuity and leverage besides just the job creation.
Well, most of these, though, are not loans. They are out-and-out grants, are they not?
Correct.
And so if a private individual puts up their share of the investment, and I was just glancing here through the packet of information and trying to find one that might work, let's use the rail spur and the grain storage facility in Union County. That must be a co-op or something, I'm just guessing. This one right here.
The very first one?
Right. So not to pick on Union County. But the question is, is the state getting a proper return on its investment merely when it asks for jobs? Not that I don't want more jobs. But my question to you is, has anyone discussed this kind of additional return? And in your opinion, is it something we should be looking at, or should we simply be happy with that which we're looking at, which is more jobs and maybe a long-term investment in a community?
Co-Chair Bentz, there's actually a transportation research board where they started to evaluate the projects. And it is one of the things that we did look at as a research project. Haven't been able to find the funds to do that yet. But, for instance, in the case of the Union County project, it wasn't just about jobs. They purchased land. They added a rail spur. So you're going to see companies be more involved in the project located there. So I guess there's jobs, but it's also around what it does for the community. I think that's, and some of that is intrinsic, I think, to the conversation, but to have a sustainable community is really kind of the long-term investment that I think that we're looking for. That it happens to create jobs is, I think, complementary to the conversation.
So as we look at the amendment and so forth, the amount of money coming from lottery and going to this purpose, the idea is that not only would we have more activity in that county short-term, but in the state's willing to make an investment in the long run in that particular area. So the thought is, and is it then called out in the application or in their report or in their argument when they're asking for this money that indeed this is going to be a long-term positive benefit to the county? And if it is, how much weight is that given? Where does it fit on this list of priorities?
Co-Chair Bentz, it is evaluated. It is one of the questions that's asked in the application. And then, as I mentioned, we actually have economists look at that aspect of what is the economic benefit to the state of Oregon to kind of to get the essence of what the applicant has identified. And they do score that, and they do prioritize that, and that information is provided, as we go through it. I think the difficulty is it is one of six considerations that we look at. We also look at how it connects modes. We look at the project readiness. We actually look at the actual job creation. So it is balanced against all of those other considerations.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Yes, Representative Wagner.
I think Representative Lindsay has some, too. When you're going through not only debt service, I would kind of like to know how much each one of these projects is, because we know what we have or how many jobs were created via that project. That way we can do our own ROI on these to get an idea of what kind of return we're getting on our investment. And I think that would get to the root of what Representative Vince was wanting to get at, so as well.
Representative Lindsay.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. They've hit on several of these, but most funds that I've participated in always have a percentage ROI or some other way to quantify the return on the investment. And what I understand right now is the only way that we're quantifying the return on the investment is the number of jobs created. Are there other ways that the OTC is quantifying the return on the investment? That's the very first question. And then the second question is you've explained how the board, how the OTC approves certain projects, but could you further explain how the fund is leveraged, how the OTC goes out and leverages those projects?
Co-Chair Bentz, Representative Lindsay. The return on investment is one, I think, that the only thing that we do look at right now is, I think, the number of jobs created as well as how much they're putting towards the match. So, in other words, if someone is putting more than the minimum 20% to the match. So we do take that under consideration. I would say through this program, it wasn't intended to be something that was quantified, but rather working with the expertise of our modal committees, certainly folks like our rail committee and our freight advisory committee and transit, they all have expertise and they understand the value of the projects that are coming forward, probably not only to the local, but also to the statewide, how it connects to the rest of the modes. So it is probably maybe one of the limiting factors to the Connect Oregon's program. And as I mentioned, when the commission, when they look at leverage, that has been scored as well. So we do rank something relative to the 20% or relative to if they provided additional funding. And one example, and I don't know if anybody from rail is here, but there was one example at a Connect One in the Henkel Yard out in eastern Oregon, and they had requested $7 million project, and this was out of Connect One. At that time, they were awarded a little over, I want to say, $3.7 million. The railroad went ahead and not only invested beyond the $7 million, but actually went to $10 million. So they recognized that the state investment was something that they wanted to pursue and to leverage even more than they had originally anticipated. So we have, I think, a number of projects like that where I think the aviation projects are probably a good example of $65 million being brought into the state with the leveraging of $5 million. So we have seen increased leverages for some projects. Others, I think, just barely make the 20%, and those are equally important projects for some of our smaller communities. So we don't try to disadvantage those who are only able to make the 20%. So it's a kind of a tricky balance there. So.
Oh. I'm sorry, Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the handout, you have the Terminal 4 pipeline and the Prineville Freight Depot. Both mentioned potential jobs. One of them is potential to create 118 new jobs, and another one says 50 additional new jobs possible. What steps are necessary to turn those into actual jobs?
Have some little notes here. So.
The Terminal 4 pipeline, the second bullet, potential to create 118 new jobs. And on the Prineville Freight Depot, the third bullet, 50 additional new jobs possible. I'm just wondering what we need to do to teeter those over to be actual jobs and not just potential jobs.
I'm not as familiar with all these projects as, right, as I probably should be. In the case of the City of Prineville, they're actually in discussions with a renewable energy company that's looking at leasing space at the Freight Depot. And that's the one where it will not only generate between 350 and 700 annual car loads for the railroad, it would create 50 direct jobs and an estimated 150 support jobs in the community. So it's one of those that they're just in process of working on. So some of it is just the timing. As I mentioned earlier, only half of the Connect 2 projects have been completed, so it's really the timing of where these projects are.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Jerry, for that presentation. I'm going to close the informational meeting and open the public hearing on House Bill 2166. Zach.
House Bill 2166 is this year's version of Connect Oregon. Authorizes issuance of lottery bonds for transportation projects funded from the Multimodal Transportation Fund.
Mm-hmm. And we have a number of people signed up. Jerry, go ahead first, Ms. Barr.
Thank you. Again, thank you, co-chairs and committee members. Jerry Bohart from the Oregon Department of Transportation. House Bill 2166, as amended by the Dash Ones, provides $40 million to the Connect Oregon program in lottery-backed revenues for multimodal transportation projects essential to promoting Oregon's economic development. Yes. And ODOT supports the Connect Oregon program. I think I've given you enough of the background of the program. I think it's important, though, to note that, as I mentioned in the tables, that there's still a lot more that needs to be done in order to supplement our investments in non-highway modes and to build upon the investments that we've made through the Connect 1, Connect 2, and Connect 3 programs. And as illustrated in the tables that I provided to you, you can see that the need certainly outstrips our ability to for available funds. I think we recognize the importance of retaining the regional equity component to the funding and following a process similar to the previous three cycles. Although, as I did mention, we all learn through each of the programs, and one of the things that we've recognized, and I've talked a little bit about the considerations that are found in the bill, is that considerations vary how we think about them from mode to mode. We have a number of policy documents, such as our Oregon Transportation Plan. We hope to have a freight plan in the next month or so. We have a rail study that was recently completed, and we actually have a ports master plan that was done approximately a year ago. And what we recognize as we go through this process is that we'll probably provide additional guidance to the applicants and to those that score our projects to really look at the policies that are in those plans that I think even provide greater guidance about how we should do our strategic investment. And so this will then focus the review that we have. So in summary, the Connect Oregon program is providing grants and loans to non-highway transportation projects across the state, resulting in improved infrastructure and creation and retention of jobs critical for Oregon. ODOT supports the Connect Oregon program as it's proven to be a valuable and a successful program that's good for our economy and for all Oregonians. And with that, I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Questions? Just have one before we hear from those signed up to testify. The it says the state received 327 eligible project apps and selected 171. Can you give us a very rough estimate of how many of those that weren't accepted? We're close enough to have made it, but for the lack of funding. Is it, are there some that are just so far out they don't even shouldn't even be there, or are all of them one way or the other likely suspects for funding?
Co-Chair Benz, if I understand your question correctly, I think certainly in each of the programs we could have funded more projects if there had been funds available. There were, however, a number of projects that really didn't meet the eligibility criteria, or I shouldn't say that, they didn't really meet the considerations fully, and so probably wouldn't have been funded. But it's fair to say that additional funds, additional projects would have been funded through all of the Connect 3 programs.
And is it also fair to say that if someone doesn't make it the first time, they came back and reapplied the second and maybe the third and so forth?
Co-Chair Benz, yes, we did have a couple of folks return, and in some cases they got funded, and in other cases they still didn't quite make the cut because other projects came forward that were deemed a higher priority.
Right. No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have quite a large number of folks signed up, so we're going to go on to a three-minute clock. Kay Van Sickle, Scott Canton, and Martin Callery. Those names sound familiar. How about Kay, Scott, and Martin?
Well, I'm Kay.
Just, I think there are two of them joining you.
Okay, committee chairs, vice chairs, and committee members. I'm Kay Van Sickle, and I'm suffering from allergies today, so excuse my voice. I seem to do this every time I come to the legislature, so what can I say? I'm representing ACEC, which is the American Council of Engineering Companies, and we represent engineering firms nationally, and I'm on the Oregon board, so I'm here to testify for ACEC Oregon chapter. You have a letter in front of you that's from one of our member firms, David Evans. I'm not going to sit here and read it to you. I think you can do that all by yourself.
Thank you.
But they're mainly talking about their support of the Connect Oregon 4 program and how it has helped in connecting various modes of transportation and also helped in economic development. In listening to the testimony that's just been given by Jerry Bohart, I did want to make a couple of points for ACEC and why we strongly support this program. It clearly is a way of providing transportation connections, and transportation is a key ingredient to provide for economic development. I think that's been proven many times through many different ways. But the other part of this program that causes it to be rather unique from other funding programs is that it is a way for a community to get money at a time when they may be struggling with other ways of funding it. In other words, if you're going after, say, state or federal funds, that can take a long time. So this is a funding program that can be leveraged so that you can move forward when you have the opportunity. If you miss those opportunities, especially for economic development, I think we're all aware that those opportunities don't sometimes come back. This program is clearly multimodal, and I wanted to speak to another aspect of it that's not necessarily related to jobs directly, and that is that it supports transit improvements. And I think in your less urban areas or your smaller urban areas, transit service is very important. It doesn't oftentimes rate high on some funding, but it provides those trips for those people to go to work, to go for medical care, and to go shopping, which all adds to the economy. So that is a clear example where where this program funds something that helps sustain the community in a broad way. So those are really the two main points I wanted to make representing ACEC, just to say again, to wrap up, that this program is critical to economic development. It helps to fund projects that wouldn't be funded otherwise as quickly, and it helps to grow Oregon. So with that, I will wrap up my comments if you have questions.
Thank you very much. We'll take questions at the end of the panel's testimony. Who wants to be next?
Okay. Co-Chairman Bentz, Co-Chairman Reed, committee members, my name is Scott Cantonwine, and I'm the president and CEO of Cascade Warehouse Company, a warehousing and rail transloading firm with operations in several locations throughout the Willamette Valley. Our company has been a strategic partner with the Portland Western Railroad for nearly a decade, and I am here today to voice support for funding of proposed Portland Western Railroad projects under the fourth round of Connect Oregon program. While Cascade Warehouse does not stand to directly benefit from these proposed projects, I am here to testify about the improvements that such projects make throughout Portland Western's value chain, including our transload facilities. By modernizing the rail infrastructure, system-wide efficiencies, improvements, and are facilitated. To that end, these projects are of merit not only on account of their direct benefit to rail users and affiliated job support and creation, but also because of the downstream benefits created. For example, when our throughput is aided because of enhanced system efficiencies, our customers benefit as well by having a reliable, updated avenue through which to move their goods to market. Finally, as our state and region stand poised for economic recovery, a strong rail infrastructure is a key component of those efforts. As I have mentioned, the benefit of the Portland and Western's proposed projects have far-reaching positive impact at various points throughout the value chain, supporting a member of Oregon businesses in the process. The Portland and Western has accomplished the previous projects on time and on budget, demonstrating efficient use of Connect Oregon funds. For all of these reasons, I strongly support the proposed projects brought forth by the Portland and Western and encourage your continued funding through the Connect Oregon program.
Thank you very much. Mr. Callery.
Co-Chair Benz, members of the committee, I'm Martin Callery. I'm Chief Commercial Officer for the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay. I'm also privileged to serve as the Vice Chair of the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee and the Southwest Area Commission on Transportation. And the port is an active member of the Oregon Rail Users League. We very much support the Connect Oregon program. The port has benefited directly from it, both in round one and in round three. Very briefly, in round one, we were able to partner with a local private sector firm to develop a multimodal connection between rail, highway, and rail. That connection has been severed because of the current situation with the rail line, but we're looking forward to that returning because we've got a couple of projects that will benefit directly from a new rail-to-marine project that we're working on now. The second project that we got during round one of Connect Oregon was funding to leverage a federal grant from the Safety Lou program that would have rehabilitated the railroad bridge across Coos Bay. It would have been phase two rehabilitation. The situation there, here again, was impacted by the embargo of the rail line and the proposal for abandonment of the line. The federal and state funds were reprogrammed in order for us to utilize them to purchase the rail line and to seek other funds, which we did through Connect Oregon 3. When we received our Connect Oregon 3 grant award, we used that again to leverage another Safety Lou program, the Tiger 2 program, and we have one smaller piece that's pending out of Safety Lou. It's a $2.5 million grant for a pilot project for utilizing a better type of rail tie on the line. So that's our experience being a user of the program, but my experience serving on the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee and the Southwest Area Commission on Transportation is quite a bit different than that, so I have sat on both sides of the table. I can tell you that on the freight advisory side, our group is very focused on making sure that the projects that go through our committee and get recommended meet the criteria and do produce significant benefit for the state of Oregon, specifically the multimodal transportation system that benefits our traded sector state. You see a little bit different thing at the Freight Advisory Committee than you do at the Area Commissions on Transportation, but I think everyone's focus is to make sure that we have good projects that meet the criteria and that support the system and create jobs, but also support the multimodal transportation system and the economy of the state. In our case, much of what we're doing in the rehabilitation area is such that the jobs are temporary, but the jobs that will occur as a result of having the right transportation system in place will be permanent. You have my testimony. There's more detail there. I'd be happy to answer questions at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Questions? Knowing that we have to keep the answer really short, is there something about the application process and the criteria you'd change? In other words, is the device working as smoothly as you would like it to, or is there something we should change as we, if we have the opportunity, since we have the opportunity?
I have to commend ODOT with the input of the legislature in making sure that every time the application process has been tweaked, it's made it harder, and that's good because you're not going to get through the process if you have a weak project or if you have a project that just doesn't meet the criteria. So I would say that every time there has been changes, there have been changes for the good. Now, it does make it harder for us out there preparing the applications, but that's okay. We should be held accountable.
Thank you very much. Further questions for this panel? See none, thank you very much. The next three folks are Ronald Russ, Cindy Roberts, and Tom Barrows.
Good afternoon. I'm Ron Russ. I'm President and General Manager of the Portland Western Railroad. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Vance and members of the committee. Portland Western is a 520-mile short line railroad. It operates in western and northwestern Oregon. I think you're familiar with it, and many of you know of the railroad and its participation in Connect Oregon over the last three tranches. We strongly support the passage of House Bill 2166 to launch the fourth tranche of funding transportation projects for Connect under the Connect Oregon program. As demonstrated by the first three Connect Oregon programs, these programs have the immediate public benefit impact of putting people to work on construction jobs. They have long-term public benefit impacts by supporting Oregon businesses and citizens who become more productive and competitive in their markets. This is crucial to allow for sustainability and the achievement of Oregon's important long-term transportation and economic development goals. Portland Western has been a direct beneficiary of putting Connect Oregon funds to work for Oregon businesses, making our rail network more efficient, and in turn, Portland and Western as a derived demand business, our customers can become more competitive in their markets. What further strengthens Connect Oregon's program is the diligent and rigorous review process that all project must undergo. There are no backroom deals. Each region of the state and each mode of transport have their own review of the projects under which all projects receive scrutiny. This project of review ensures that the best multimodal projects for Oregon are the ones ultimately approved by the Oregon Transportation Commission. I applaud the state of Oregon for developing such a review process, and the results of the first three programs should serve as models for public-private partnerships elsewhere in the United States. I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent Union Pacific Railroad, along with Roger Martin, who's in the room to answer all the difficult questions when they come up. Nationwide, Union Pacific extols the virtues of the program Connect Oregon. It's unique, and it's wonderful, and it is helping us to improve freight and passenger rail statewide, which benefits citizens and businesses alike. I wanted to tell you a little bit about Oregon's progress via Union Pacific. Since 2005, we've spent $500 million on infrastructure in Oregon. $10 million of that was from Connect Oregon. All the projects within Connect Oregon that we've been involved in are excellent projects that would eventually rise to the top and get done. But the fact is we have 23 states competing for our infrastructure dollars, so it's very difficult to get to all expediently. But I will tell you that Connect Oregon helps some of the smaller projects nationwide rise to the top, and Union Pacific's queue, because the state has shown a priority in a project, so we will too. With or without Connect Oregon, in 2011, we'll be spending $21.4 million on capacity in Oregon, $33.5 million to enhance the rail line between Harrisburg and Oak Ridge, and we're also planning to spend $74 million on the Brooklyn Intermodal Yard. So our investment will continue here, but we certainly appreciate the opportunity to partner with you on some of the smaller district projects that need to be done around the state. You know, our commitment to Oregon goes beyond just the rail infrastructure and the safety improvements. We also are very active in the communities where our employees live. Union Pacific just finalized grants totaling about $250,000 to fund our principal partnership program statewide, and a lot of nonprofits, including Malheur County Special Advocates, the Eugene Symphony, she left, Solve, Loaves and Fishes, Boys and Girls Club, and United Way statewide. So we're very involved. Along with our 1,500 employees in Oregon, we at UP are committed to improving Oregon's rail infrastructure, passenger and freight rail, and communities. And we thank you for helping us do that.
Thank you, Ms. Robert. Mr. Burrows.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Burrows representing BNSF Railway, and I want to echo what Ms. Robert said. Experiences of BNSF in the state are similar. We also strongly urge you to support continuing the Connect Oregon program. Its funding and project selection procedure is a model in our 28 states. Repeatedly held up Oregon's program in other states as a way of addressing infrastructure needs apart from roads and highways. Unfortunately, a lot of other states aren't as forward-thinking as Oregon, and so it's been an uphill battle. Our concern is that we continue the program because, as has been indicated earlier, if once it goes away, it's much harder to get started back up. Connect One was very difficult load to carry up the hill. There were a lot of concerns about what the results would be. The fact that Connect 2 and Connect 3 were so overwhelmingly supported, I think, indicates how successful this has been. And on a final note, I'd like to point out that since the Connect Oregon process has been in place, Ms. Roberts' railroad and my railroad have not been shooting each other across the rivers as they did 100 years ago. I don't know if there's a correlation, but I just wanted to point out that the railroad wars, we're on the same side now, sitting on the same side of the table. Thank you.
Everybody on. Thank you. Just a few more questions before Please. The power shifts. What I'd be interested in knowing is this. The three fairly good-sized railroads. The question is, how do we measure this input so that it indeed is, I guess Russ's argument is the easiest because he's all in Oregon, but for those of you who are in Oregon and other states, how do you point out that it's actually benefiting the state and that we're not just improving the rail for you to drive across Oregon? By the way, this is an argument I hear a lot about the roads across eastern Oregon. You
yes.
know, we have them there, but we just drive across you. That kind of an argument.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Cindy Robert for the record. You know, it's a good question, but I will assure you that UP could do a lot of projects in a lot of different places and not spend the money where we do. We've received money for four projects since Connect Oregon was instigated, and Hinkle Yard was one of our largest. So that was out in eastern Oregon. Would that have been done eventually? Yes. But like I say, with 23 states, sad to hear you have 28, but with 23 states, it's not going to get the highest priority. St. John's Track was another one, Barnes Yard, Albany improvements. We've had four projects that we were the lead on, but you have to understand, Representative, that most of the projects are done by local governments, and we write letters supporting those. We help them with the projects of these rail ones, and then we come in and help finance them, but we're not the lead on those. We've only gotten received money for four projects where we were actually the lead on, but it still does require that local government input.
Hello, Mr. Chair. It's safe to say then that the criteria or the methodology that we utilize in the program forces those projects to be beneficial to the state as opposed to Nebraska. Is that a correct statement?
Yes, sir. And I think that the OTC, thank you for rephrasing all that for me, that was very good. I think the OTC has also done an excellent job in making sure that both the modes and the regions have been well served by the program.
Thank you.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so I understand this, my understanding is there's a handful of small projects out there that would likely not get done. It would be put down on the bottom of the totem pole but for this program. And the state inputs will pay for 20, 30, 40, maybe 50% of that project. And my question is, what does the state get in return for that investment except for jobs? Do we get any equity in any way, or is it just the jobs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, I could let you two answer, but you know how I am. I think that you put your finger on a good point. What is the overall return? As you were told earlier, there has to be a 20-year life cycle for whatever project is done. So we know at the very least that for 20 years there's going to be some value. But when it comes to the smaller areas of Oregon, it's not just the value of having the freight move through faster, being able to drive the grocery truck from one grocery store to the other quicker, being able to get passengers out. It's also the safety issue. And most of the programs that you see in local areas that we've written letters for and we've helped finance, because we've provided the match for many of those, most of those were safety issues. And we just can't put a dollar amount on that. One of the questions you have been asking is about the jobs. I would say that perhaps the jobs really are temporary jobs, but when you have a series of temporary jobs, it becomes somewhat permanent.
And I would argue that, take it in a way here, there are also supporting situations here. When you invest in a line segment like a Portland Western line segment, we'll just pick the A line, for example, from Linton to Astoria. When you're doing that, when you invest in that line, you're not only upgrading it for safety, because it was built for a standard that was appropriate for World War II, but you're also improving it for all the industries that are on that line who rely on rail services. What you're doing is supporting all those jobs, if you will, for the 20 years that that investment's in place that allows for that rail service to be improved to the modern standard and to be capable of handling safely the commodities that the railroads handle. So you're not only looking at the construction jobs, which is a great short-term spike, but without that, you're going to have to support all these industries. Taking an example, the Georgia Pacific facility at Wana, Sean Tevens log loading facility at Rainier, Boise Cascade at St. Helens. All those industries rely upon, in some aspect, for their inputs or outputs on rail services. And without that investment, you're not going to see those jobs carried forward.
Thank you very much. I see that we have quite a few more folks who want to testify, so appreciate you being here. And we'll call up the next group. Paul Langner, Steve Dickey, and Lana Butterfield, please. And as the good co-chair, I understand, indicated, given our time frame, we'll be asking for 3 minutes. Maximum of 3 minutes for each of you. That doesn't obligate you to fill the full 3 minutes, so if you can summarize your points more quickly than that, it would be appreciated. Since you're ready to go, sir.
Well, thank you, Co-Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Steve Dickey. I'm the Director of Transportation Development for Salem-Keizer Transit. We just want to come today to offer our support also for the Connect Oregon program and offer up a couple of examples of the projects that we've received funding for and where they are at this time. In 2004, Salem-Keizer Transit adopted its strategic business plan, and in that plan, it laid the future design standards for our services, which focused around a project design model, which we call our 3 C's model, which focuses around corridors, connectors, and our corridor circulators and centers. In 2009, first time in 30 years, we did a major redesign of our service, which was to improve service along the corridors and the circulators, but we still needed our transit centers. Centers, according to the definition in our plan, are facilities that are designed to be small transit connecting points to enhance the ability for our passengers to connect throughout our service area without having to go all the way downtown to make transfers. These centers allow several routes to meet for efficient transfers, provide for park-and-ride facilities, and have sheltered locations for passengers to wait for their bus. The Connect Oregon 2 and 3 grants that we received have provided critical funding for two of our center's projects. The first project is the Kaiser Transit Center that received just over $2.5 million in Connect Oregon 2 funding that has been matched with just over $3.3 million of Federal Transit Administration and American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds. The property for this project is actually in the process of being purchased as we speak. Construction is anticipated to begin late spring and or early summer with a completion date of late this year. It will provide opportunity for 8 to 10 buses to come together, 50 to 70 parking spaces, a break room for our operators, and most importantly, it gives a better ability for the people in the north end of our service district to connect across to critical locations like Chickamauga Community College, to shopping areas like Kaiser Station and so forth. The second project is a Rick Rial Park and Ride project that received $243,000 in Connect Oregon 3 funding. This project is also underway. The regional project is possible in this particular case with the partnership with Polk County and the Polk County Fairgrounds. We have a signed 50-year lease for a parcel of property that is adjacent to Highway 99W at the Polk County Fairgrounds. The project will connect regional services with people needing access to public transportation either by car or between various service providers in the area. The facility will have a bus transfer area for 2 to 3 buses, 40 to 50 parking spaces, and a sheltered area for passengers to wait. And this project is...
Wrap up, please. We're at 3 minutes.
Okay. Just wanted to focus that that project is a prime opportunity where multiple agencies have come together to make this project possible. And finally, just want to wrap up by saying the investments made in the various Connect Oregon projects are truly an investment for Oregon's future, the quality of life, and the commitment to seeing our resources be put to work in a way that we can all be proud of.
Thank you very much. Ms. Butterfield.
Mr. Chair, co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm the executive director for the Oregon Rail Users League. And many of the folks who have testified today are members of ORUL. We support Connect Oregon wholeheartedly. We have a very diverse membership. Not only the class ones and short lines, passenger rail, ports, shippers, engineering firms, and a great diversity of interest. But we all support Connect Oregon and have done so in all of its versions. We believe that Connect Oregon helps to attract and sustain business and jobs in Oregon and connects Oregon to world markets because Oregon does sit on the edge of the Pacific Rim, and we believe that that is important. And so we want you to have our support as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Butterfield. The model for all of us to follow. 1 minute. Well done.
I wish I could be that lucid. I'm Paul Langer.
We have three. Yes.
Yes, sir. Paul Langer with Teven Brothers Land and Timber Company. Thank you, co-chairs.
Thank you.
I'm here as a project, so I'm probably bringing a little different perspective here. Teven Brothers, we're a small intermodal facility in Rainier, Oregon. Rail, water, and traffic and highway trucks put together is a reload facility for logs and timber products. We export and go offshore Hawaii, Alaska, British Columbia, California. 2002, we started moving logs on rail cars. Did 700 rail cars that year and bought with 7 employees. In 2006, our customers started saying, there's an interest out here. We'd like to do something more. We think we can move more logs on rail cars. We did. And by 2008, we were moving 10,000 rail cars a year, which is about 38,000 truckloads that didn't come up I-5, didn't go through the Turwilliger curves, didn't flow through anything here. We have a Connect Oregon 3 project. We're just about done with it. We should finish it hopefully in the next 45 days. We're going to add additional spur and add additional laydown area. On September 28th this year, we got a call from one of our customers that said, we've got a problem with our major dock in Longview, Washington. Can we divert some lumber to your facility to go to California? We said, yeah, bring it on. How much? 12.5 million board feet. We want to do it every 3 weeks.
Wow.
That the next day, we got a call from the railroad saying it's time. We would like to start moving out of Santiam and move lumber down there about 4.5 million board feet every 3 weeks. It went forward. We turned it on. Between September 28th and December 24th, we had no time off. Everybody worked 7 days a week. By the end of it, we'd earned our reputation. At the same time, the Chinese market for log export took off. We were moving 10,000 rail cars a year with logs. We're on track to move 12,000 rail cars with logs right now. The lumber that started moving just in September, we've now signed long-term agreements. We'll be moving those for the additional 1,500 rail cars annually for those. Log cars on rail convert to about 3.5 truckloads per car. On lumber, it's about 4, especially this time of year with wood. Our question is, okay, what have you done for us employment-wise? When we filled out our Connect Oregon 3 application, we said we wanted to hit 17 people. If we could hit 17, we'd be good. We've had 5 to the dock, 5 to the barker, 3 to the scalers. Net, we have 28 new employees at Teven Brothers in Rainier, Oregon, population 1,200. But that's not just us. The barging company added another 3 employees. The railroad has another shift up there, another 3 employees. The stevedoring companies, we added 12 more shifts, which equates to about another 24 FTE.
And I'm afraid we're coming right up on 3 minutes now.
And avoided traffic, 45,000 truckloads will not be going up I-5 this year if we go through. And we have 3-year commitments on these jobs.
Appreciate your testimony very much. Thank you all for being here. With that, we're not quite through with the people who want to be heard on this bill, but given Representative Tomei's patience, we're going to simultaneously open a public hearing on House Bill 2179. Representative Tomei and Ms. Bennett, if you want to come forward, Zach, you can give us a quick summary of the bill, and we'll... Please.
House Bill 2179 allows for registration fees to be used to pay off county bond fees and debts.
Representative Tomei, thank you for waiting.
Thank you so much for allowing me to come to testify today. I am State Representative Carolyn Tomei. I represent Milwaukee and portions of Southeast Portland. And in particular, I represent the historic Selwood neighborhood, which is home to the very historic Selwood Bridge. I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about House Bill 2179. This measure is a technical fix to last session's transportation package, House Bill 2001, which I'm sure many of you remember. This is needed to move the Selwood Bridge forward, the bridge project. This bill does not impact the state, but our local counties need it to provide certainty around their financing plan. The Selwood Bridge is an 85-year-old bridge spanning the Willamette River. It has reached the end of its useful life. It is functionally and structurally obsolete. It has a rating of 2 out of 100 on a bridge sufficiency scale. This narrow two-lane bridge has a single substandard sidewalk, and it has no bike lanes. Buses and heavy trucks are prohibited from crossing. I have participated in the extensive planning process with my constituents and other community members to choose a locally preferred alternative and bridge design. City, county, state, and federal agencies are all involved and have finally reached consensus. After many, many, many years of discussion, we are finally ready to move forward with construction in 2012. But unfortunately, we have discovered this little tiny glitch in last session's legislation, and we need this very tiny fix. And we have representatives here from Multnomah County to explain the technicalities to you, and I urge you to support this bill and move it to the House with a due pass recommendation. So thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and Committee.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Ms. Bennett.
Okay.
Good to hear from you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Bentz, and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Bennett, here today from Multnomah County, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2179. As Representative Tomei mentioned, this is a technical fix from House Bill 2001. As you may recall, that bill gave Multnomah County and Clackamas County permission to enact a local vehicle registration fee for the purpose of design, replacement, engineering, and construction of the Selwood Bridge. The problem and the reason we're here today with House Bill 2179 is that the original language did not specify that the revenue collected from a vehicle registration fee could be used to pay debt service and costs related to bonds. Although we felt the legislative intent was very clear about the purpose of the local VRF, our bond council has advised us that in order to give unqualified opinion to investors that a pledge of these fees is valid and binding obligation of the county, a statutory change is necessary. So this bill simply clarifies this point by adding the language may be used to pay debt service and costs related to bonds and other obligations for such purposes. So it's a very simple little fix here. We are here with some urgency because we need to move forward with the financing of this project. Our timeline, as Representative Tomei mentioned, calls for this project to begin next year. She talked about the urgent need for replacement. If you've ever driven over the bridge and been slightly terrified, you know that it needs to be replaced. We've talked about this bridge for a very long time and finally have a project and financing available to us to move forward with it. I would mention that there are weight restrictions on the bridge right now. Trucks, large vehicles can't cross the bridge. That will get fixed, of course. And this is the busiest two-lane bridge in Oregon. It carries 30,000 cars a day. If we were to close the bridge at some point, and if we can't fix it, we'll have to. Those 30,000 vehicles go to other Willamette River bridges, 205, and other areas and create further congestion in an already pretty congested area. And also mentioned that this bridge project will create 4,000 jobs. So we, again, appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has the glitch caused any delays in the project?
Not yet. We have been able to come up with some bridge financing that is continuing to move forward.
Bridge
financing for a bridge, yes. And
just
so
to make sure
far
which
we are,
one we met there.
So far we are on track because this is a bridge, and I'm not a bridge engineer, thank goodness, but there are requirements about certain time frame when you're in the water to do certain parts of the bridge. So we do hope that we can get this fixed this spring and get moving forward with it.
Mm-hmm. Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you just said that this would create 4,000 jobs. That seems like a lot. How are you calculating that?
Co-Chair Reed, Representative Lindsay, I don't have the answer to that for you right now. That is a number that has been given to me by our county administrators, and I will find out and get back to you about that.
Yeah. Well, Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So given the area I represent, Clackamas, and the gigantic stink that's going on regarding vehicle registration fees and the Selwood Bridge, can you describe kind of how this legislation would fit into that issue, or what we need to be considering about that?
Sure. Co-Chair Reed, Representative Sheehan. This bill doesn't directly relate to the situation going on in Clackamas County. This bill only applies if Multnomah County or Clackamas County had a vehicle registration fee. It's really just, again, the assurance that our bond council feels they need in order to move forward with financing. I think the Clackamas County vehicle registration fee will be on the May ballot, and whatever happens with that, that county will have to move forward and decide what is next. So their part of the funding of the project is relatively small, so I think there will be ways to address that when it happens.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looks like you're addressing all the counties with this. Are there other counties that are going to be facing this issue with projects?
Co-Chair Reed, Representative Widener, this bill only applies, this original provision in House Bill 2001 only applied to Multnomah and Clackamas County, again, for the purpose of the Selwood Bridge. There was, as I recall, a conversation about vehicle registration fees for counties, and we asked, given sort of the urgency of replacing the bridge, that we could be given the permission sooner than other counties. I'm not sure So at this moment, it doesn't apply to any other county, I guess is the short answer to your question.
I've just been advised that even if we were all ready and all completely comfortable, we don't have the revenue statement, unfortunately, so we won't be able to decide whether we're ready to move it today, if that changes anyone's interest in further questions. But I imagine we will return to the bill when we have that necessary paperwork and then consider whether we're ready to move it forward. So if there aren't any other questions, appreciate you being here, and
yep, thank
hope
you.
To see you again. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2179. As you recall, we still have the public hearing on House Bill 2166 open. There are four people left to testify on that bill. We have three chairs, so I'll call three. John Charles, Mark Pangburn. Thank you. Sorry about that. Jana Jarvis. And Ms. Shipwreck, you're in a good spot to be the cleanup hitter after these three.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan policy research center. I appreciate this opportunity. I'm going to provide a slightly different perspective on this bill than you've heard so far. I have three points I'd like to make. First is that this approach breaks the relationship between those who use the facility and those who pay. And Oregon has a much lauded cost responsibility approach that you've tried to actually refine over time through the weight mile tax and revisions to it. And I served for 7 years on the Oregon Road User Fee Task Force that was tasked by you to look for ways to replace the gas tax with something even more precise. And I support user fees across all modes. This particular approach is sort of the Santa Claus approach, which is that it doesn't matter what users are willing to pay or what benefits there are. Money is just sort of airdropped in randomly through a pork barrel process. And, of course, that's why so many people are here. There's widespread support for Santa Claus for projects. But if users themselves are not willing to pay, then that's a problem from my standpoint. And when you look at some of the projects in here, this one in particular, the streetcar, you know, it's not as if you can't identify users or you can't identify beneficiaries. In this particular case, you have users who are not paying any of the capital cost, only 2% of the operating cost, and about 2 cents per boarding on average. You know, if the people providing the service think that the service is literally almost worthless, and if the beneficiaries think it's almost worthless, then why would we spend lottery money for it? Second point is, this bill requires you to make a finding that this is going to promote economic development in the state as required under the Constitution, but you don't actually know that because you don't even know where this is going to go. You're delegating all your authority to pick projects to the OTC. So how do you know that? If you actually want to do this by the pork barrel method, put all the projects in the statute. And my final point is my one handout, this yellow sheet that I believe gets to Representative Widener's point earlier, which I thought was probably the most important thing proponents of this bill should talk about, which is the revenue, the debt coverage, and the fact that the trends for this are that in the last 5 years, total revenue of the lottery are stagnant or declining. P&I payments have tripled in the last 10 years, and in the last 4 years, debt coverage has gone from 8.54 down to 4.14. From a public finance standpoint, these are all undesirable trends. You're maxing out the credit card, unless there's something about this that I don't understand, which means you're getting to spend the money now, and you are foreclosing options for your successors in this body as you keep securitizing future revenues. So I believe this whole bill needs a lot more consideration, and that the more you break the link between direct users and beneficiaries, the more off track you get the state. I believe we should be linking even tighter those who pay and those who benefit. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. And I'm assuming that your testimony, though you mentioned your reference to Santa Claus, you're not here to oppose Santa Claus. Is that true?
I keep waiting for Santa Claus, and I do support him.
Okay. Thank you very much. I still haven't pronounced your name correctly, I don't believe, but...
That's all right. It's Pangborn, actually. Unusual, easy to say. Chair Reed and Co-Chair Bence and members of the committee. I'm Mark Pangborn. I'm the General Manager of Lane Transit District as well as the President of the Oregon Transit Association. And as the President of the Transit Association, I'm here to express the Association's support of this bill. From the material that was given to you by Ms. Bohard, you could see Transit has been a recipient of all three of the projects. And in fact, of the material that you got, we had two of those. The one was our bus rapid transit project, and another was a park and ride in Veneta. Both of them real critical, which leads to a point I think is important here. Transit has been really focusing on really moving people to jobs, and in the process creating jobs and creating access to jobs. And in doing so, we have really been very limited in kind of the money we've had for capital projects. And although we do have access to federal monies, often we don't have the local match. And that has been one of the really geniuses of this project, is it has provided a local match that has allowed us to leverage federal dollars. In the case of our bus rapid transit project, we were able to leverage $33 million of federal funds with about $5 million of the Connect Oregon One money, and that is true to a lesser or greater degree with all these projects. So it has allowed the transit districts really to be able to think ahead and put in, if you look at the park and rides, the kinds of things that are in the project for economic development, forward thinking in terms of economic development. So I would urge you to consider funding. You've talked about, well, with only $40 million, should we look at a different way of allocating the money? I think the value of having a regional allocation as well as a motor one, that is transit and rail, et cetera, is that it does allow all states, all parts of the state to have money, so it can garner that support. But I think with a lesser amount of money, you might want to consider adjusting that and seeing how that works in terms of looking maybe more at the modes, but with still a regional distribution. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Jarvis.
Thank you, Chair Reed, Co-Chair Bence, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jana Jarvis, representing the Oregon Wheat Growers League. Some of you weren't familiar that that's who I'm representing now. So
Thanks for clarifying.
So I just wanted to be here to offer sort of some generic support for House Bill 2166. When you have to think about moving grain to market, you have to think about the fact that the pricing, the freight costs that are inherent in the cost of moving the goods to market are not something that are negotiated by the producer. They're not, and they aren't factored into the cost of the product itself. And so our members are always looking for the least expensive and the most options for being able to move product to market. There were a couple of times when the locks were closed and we moved grain by rail rather than by barge. Those kinds of things and having those options are important to us. And I think you can see the investment in the grain elevator in Union County as an example of something that we have been supportive of in the past. So with that, I just wanted to offer our support for this bill and available for any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. I don't see any burning questions, so we appreciate you being here. One last person on the bill, Mr. Shiprack, you're ready to go.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Bence, Co-Chair Reed. I've got some written testimony that I'll let you read. In the interest of time, I'll be brief. I'm Bob Shiprack. I'm stepping in today for Mr. John Molis, representing the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. I was at the jobs rally at noon today, and
I guess we should interrupt for a moment here. We have your written testimony. How would you like us to fill in the blank where your name is not listed? Because my name is, and there's a bunch of, it's underscored.
You can just write it in.
Okay.
I just want to make a couple points that perhaps were not made, and then I'll take any questions. But I'm very familiar with Connect Oregon. It's a great program. It's very innovative. It's one of those programs that I personally think is demonstrates what good government is supposed to look like. I also want to make one comment about it, and was just brought up about the issue of cost responsibility and all that. If, in fact, these funds were from the Highway Trust Fund, I would agree with those reservations. However, these are lottery funds, and I just want to point out to everyone that when the voters of Oregon passed the measure creating the lottery fund, it was for economic development, and I'm glad to see this being used. The last thing I'll say, I like the competitive nature of these programs. And lastly, for those, particularly those of you from more rural areas, these programs, these projects allow us to maintain employment for our apprenticeship programs so that the young people who want to have a career in construction have a chance at good paying jobs in rural Oregon. And I want to just tell the committee that we're signing up a lot of young people in those programs, and it's a great thing, leading to the finest construction workforce in the United States. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, you prompted a question.
I knew I would.
So it's not like Santa Claus, it's like winning the lottery when you get one of these projects, then, is what you're saying?
But based upon a competitive review, which I think is very exhaustive, and I think that's a very good thing. I like competition.
I think, if I may follow up.
Follow up.
The concern that I have is some of these projects that we're picking are sitting mm-hmm. empty. I mean, I'm looking at the Vinita parking lot that's empty. You drive through lots of times when I've driven by there, I don't see cars in it, and this is a project that we had picked and thought was appropriate. So that's where I'm wondering if we don't need more oversight and pick the ones that are going to be winners for the state for economic development rather than just letting a department pick what we want to do with the money and build something that's not used at all.
I obviously can't comment, Mr. Chair, on this particular project. I'm totally unfamiliar with it, but as one of the earlier testifiers mentioned, every time it's been tweaked, it appears that the projects of more importance do rise to the top. So you raise a valid concern.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you. And I just want to maybe ask a question of our good committee member, Representative Widener, and ask him when he usually drives through this. This is a very commuter.
Actually, the Willamette. When we go to Florence, we go that direction, and then there's a mill actually over the hill on the other side that I do work at.
Okay. So during the work week?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we are also waiting on the paperwork for 2166, so we won't be able to take it any further today, but really appreciate the significant hearing and testimony on it. So we will close.
Can I ask a question before we do?
Representative Smith?
Sort of the chair or maybe committee staff or maybe the room, if somebody who is aware of the process that happens can give information about, and I didn't want to belabor the conversation today, but information about how projects get changed over time as populations change. And I had a question from some people in my district about it and would love to talk to somebody who's apprised of it.
I think that's likely. You're getting some nods from the back of the room, someone who can follow up with you.
Thanks,
appreciate
for sure.
The question. Thank you. So that will close the public hearing on House Bill 2166. Do we need to carry that over or
please can
we reschedule? So we'll carry over House Bill 2166 on the agenda. We will also carry over House Bill 2179 for a future work session. And we're now ready to open a work session on House Bill 2960 and get an update on some of the work that's been going on since we last heard it. I saw Representative Bailey moments ago. I don't know if he sat down or escaped the room for a moment. There he is. And see where you can. I was looking in the back. So Representative Bailey, please come forward. And anyone else you'd like to bring with you, please do.
Thank you, Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Benz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey, representing House District 42. Thank you for opening this work session today, as I believe the committee probably already understands. The intention here is not to ask you to consider moving an amendment or a piece of legislation today, but rather to give you an update on where we are on working on the amendment, given what we believe the importance of this bill is and given the good questions that came forward from this committee in the public hearing that we had last week. And I believe, not to speak for him, but that Representative Smith and I would be happy to answer additional questions from the committee. My intention is to turn this over to Scott Nelson from the Governor's Office and a few stakeholders today to comment on where we are on this process, address some of the concerns that were brought up by the committee, and talk a little bit about some of the impacts in the amendment that is under process and in the works right now. So with that, I'd turn it over to others, if that's okay, Mr. Co-Chair.
Absolutely. Thank you. Representative Bailey. Mr. Nelson, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My name is Scott Nelson, and I work for the Governor, and I've been working on this with Representative Smith and Representative Bailey and a number of you for quite a while. I wanted to, this is a repeat performance from a couple months ago when we laid out our basic plan, and I think that what I'd like to do is just to generally tell you that as a matter of legislation, we're working with a number of your colleagues, and I think that very shortly we should have a piece of legislation that that really does create an ability for our schools to take advantage of these projects that, of course, create jobs, save money for the schools, make for healthier kids and teachers, improve scores in the classroom, and has, of course, a range of benefits. Just by way of very brief overview, because I think that this will be much more clear when we actually have the amendment drafted. We're talking about a number of mechanisms. One, leveraging existing $1,149 with some preferred bonding, like qualified energy conservation bonds, to get an incredibly low rate for schools, so that in fact many measures pencil out and can hopefully, in a best case scenario, return money to schools immediately. And of course, keep in mind that these are revenue streams that otherwise aren't available to schools. So it's not sort of taking from schools money. It's actually taking money that would not otherwise be available, using it productively for the schools and making operations cheaper for them. The legislation will also have a mechanism by which we can take a capitalized account and buy down the interest and package. Make a finance package that is available and easy for schools to deal with. And then finally, the other thing that I think we want to achieve with this legislation is a way to chart a path forward for directly using energy savings and monetizing those savings up front to make this a process that can bounce across to other public buildings and into the private sector. That's the holy grail, and that's where that's the holy grail of energy efficiency. And I think that's what we want to achieve. We want to achieve a mechanism by which that works quickly and easily. So there's all sorts of other angles to the legislation, but I do think last time we talked about how projects, for instance, can pencil out, With your leave, Mr. Co-Chair, I'll get some of these materials to the committee administrator for distribution. But we've got a range of case studies from similar efforts. And one that the Department of Energy spoke to very directly earlier today was about a $275,000 retrofit of lighting in the Woodburn schools, and assuming 5.5% loan, and we're hoping to drive the cost down much lower than that. The project was paid off in would be paid off in 6 years from the savings, along with in Woodburn, in fact, they used ETO and other Betsy and some Betsy to drive it even lower. So they started getting a payback immediately.
Does your six-year figure include or exclude ETO and Betsy dollars?
That excludes it. That's a hypothetical because they didn't do that.
Okay.
They got money right away.
Thank you.
So in any case, I have a range of other examples. Mount Hood Community College famously did a project with Johnson Controls that's paying back, and they went very deep, and that's paying back over 17 years. I think it's something like $10.7 million in savings.
So Representative Beyer has a question, and then I have one too. Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On these projects, are you building in an inflation cost to the cost of electricity when you look at the payout?
Yes, that is calculated with a cost of inflation. The Woodburn example includes inflation. And I think that the cost of energy, of course, is a key element in figuring out how this pencils out.
And in fact, that's an excellent segue to a question I know the co-chair and I share. So I'll put sort of two questions. One is if you could help us, and I don't mean to jump your question here, but I know we were both interested in kind of a list of the assumptions that underlie what makes the program work. And to the extent you can, I know there are a number of other people who are interested in commenting too, that you could give us an update on where the amendment is in process and what it will look like when it comes. This is a significantly complicated idea, so to as much as you can give us a preview of what we're likely to see so we can begin thinking and doing our own sort of due diligence, that would be very helpful. Representative Benson, do you want to amend or edit my assumptions question at all?
Not much, I'll just add to it.
Sure.
The question, that one of the questions that came up was how many different things have to keep happening as they have been in order to make this thing work? And that was how the conversation was going. So if you have a few you could launch into, we'd appreciate it.
Sure. Stable energy prices are a significant help in penciling these things out. We have had, with the exception of some short-term blips, very stable prices in the Northwest. We've been blessed with that. There are a number of mechanisms that we can, advanced mechanisms, and perhaps Representative Bailey wants to talk about this, but there are mechanisms that we intend to try to prove up through this process where we can essentially share the risk of, or offset the risk of, for instance, a huge jump in energy prices. But that's a pretty advanced model. What we're talking about as a first phase is relatively short payback periods, so it minimizes that risk of energy prices interfering. And in addition, when we, just as a straight public policy matter, when we look at schools, this is all avoided cost. So it's not necessarily a question as to whether the school ends up paying more or less in because due to a rise in energy prices, but rather the cost they avoid even in the event of an increase in energy prices.
So, Bailey, do you have anything you want to add?
Coach Reed, Coach Bentz, I would just add to those comments very briefly a couple of things. One, part of the reason that I believe Mr. Nelson has provided to you the studies that you will have before you is to help get at some of this question about what are the assumptions that underlie the model, and to address some of the concerns that came up about whether or not these kinds of projects pencil, and to show that, in fact, that in the private sector they have penciled. And while we weren't able to get McKinstry to come down for the work session today, they have indicated to us that they are essentially on call for questions that the committee has around how they've been able to make this work in the private sector and how these kinds of models can work out. It is predicated on a couple of assumptions that I believe we've discussed and we're happy to get into a little bit more deeply. One, there's an assumption that if the 1149 mechanism moves forward, that that program will continue through the life of the program. Two, the energy prices, as Mr. Nelson said, will remain the same or more likely rise. That doesn't seem to be a very unlikely assumption. These projects will pencil and can pencil depending on the depth, even if energy prices don't rise. We're assuming that they aren't going to drop off a cliff dramatically and we're going to invent cold fusion and suddenly have free power for everybody. But in the absence of that...
You wouldn't oppose that, though, would
you? I would not oppose that, Mr. Co-Chair, and would be very happy if we had suddenly cheap, clean, renewable power for everybody. But in the absence of that, it is highly likely, and has been reported from the utilities themselves, that we are likely to see at least some price increases over time in the cost of energy, for better or for worse. And third, there's an assumption here that these projects will be done right, that there will be quality in the jobs that are done, and I think you'll hear a little bit more about that from some of the other folks that are coming up to testify, and that that quality will then translate into the kinds of expected savings that we want to see out of these projects, and that we will save the energy that we project. There will be a little bit of a discount because you can't always quite nail it right exactly when you're looking at it from the beginning, but that they will deliver close to that value. And then over time, the hope is to put a couple of pieces, and you'll see that in the amendment that's going to come before you, that would enable some of the next generation kinds of financing that we have discussed at length last session and this session around how do we really start to count generation more like we count, or excuse me, count efficiency more like we count generation, and be able to enable some more sophisticated models around utility investment in energy efficiency that would provide a win for ratepayers as well as a win for how we invest in and maintain energy over time. But in order to get there, you need data. And what this does is create an initial stream of data off which we can innovate on those models, and we hope to be able to codify in the legislation a desire to take that data and create with it the next generation of models that will really put Oregon at the front of the pack on how we leverage private sector investment in energy efficiency.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's not clear to me whether I should be in that chair or this chair, but this is comfortable enough.
Up to you.
Partly a comment, partly a question for us going forward. So the co-chair's question on assumptions, I think, gets to the central question. And ultimately, we have to make a bet on which is more likely if there is significant deviation from stable energy prices, is it more likely that those energy prices will be wrong to the north or to the south? Right? And I think, and I am not qualified to offer that answer from the podium right now. I will offer my own hunch and even use an example, but we might want to get sort of our best sterling projections on saying, hey, this is our best projections, but by the way, if we're wrong, we're probably not wrong because energy prices went way down, right, setting aside the cold fusion possibility. And the example I'll offer is Bonneville. When Bonneville penciled, it penciled not nearly as well as it turned out because people underestimated the rise in energy costs. It seems to me from everything we've heard and working on this that is a much more likely result than us overestimating energy prices. And so I'll just say that, but it'll probably be helpful for us to get really good data to the committee, and we can try to find some. Thank you.
Indeed.
So there are a few other folks, I think, who would like to be heard, and I'm aware of the time. So, Representative Lindsay, you have a
sure, question? I just had some questions.
Okay, for this panel or
sure.
For some others? Okay, go ahead. I do want to get to at least two other people, so if you
sure,
can,
I'll make them brief.
Sure, thank you.
So, Representative Bailey, last time that you were here, I think I asked you how much it would cost the state, and you said not a dime.
Mm-hmm.
I've looked at the statute or the bill, and it specifically says in Section 1, monies in the fund are continuously appropriated to the State Department of Energy to support the grant and loan program. And then in Section 2, it says the Jobs Energy Schools Fund shall consist of monies accepted by the Department of Energy and all others and all other monies received for the fund from any other source.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain that?
Absolutely. Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Benz, Representative Lindsay, that's a great question. So there's a couple of parts to the answer to your question, and I would stand by the comment that I made last time that the financing structure that as we've envisioned it in the amendments that are coming does not encumber the general fund in any way. The bill that you see before you is simply a shell. and we expect that the amendments that we give you will gut and stuff the bill, and that's one of the reasons why we're here before you today to talk about the process of what we're working on for the amendments. That said, there will likely still be a Jobs, Energy, and Schools Fund within the subsequent amendments. And what that bill, what the bill shell as written does is just create an account with the Receipts Authority. It doesn't actually put any money in the account. And then so what we're looking at doing is essentially having a pathway for loan dollars and a pathway for one-time dollars, and those can work in concert. And as we discussed last time, I believe through your question, those loan dollars and those one-time dollars are existing funds through existing programs that aren't taxpayer dollars through the state general fund that we are combining to work in concert better to make these programs more efficient and to be able to innovate on how we use those dollars to achieve low-cost or no-cost financing. So, for example, you can use a small-scale energy loan through Article, I believe it's 11J in the Constitution that we have as a reserve-backed fund to make energy loans as we've been doing for a while, and then be able to make those loans more effective and lower cost for the district by combining that with Senate Bill 1149 public purpose charge dollars that have been previously going to school districts already, and then just bringing those dollars from the school districts in combination with that loan. We're not taking any money away from school districts or giving them dollars that they didn't have before, but combining those things together to make those loans more effective for school districts. That's one example of a potential financing option that combines those dollars in a way that would respect the budget challenges that we have and the need to create more efficiency in government.
And quick follow-up. Just to clarify, you said that you qualified your answer saying it wouldn't cost a dime from the general fund. So the first clarifying question is, does it cost the state a dime outside of the general fund? That's first. And then second is, it says in the second phase to promote the development of clean energy in Oregon. Is that related to K through 12, or is that outside the scope of K through 12?
Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Bentz, Representative Lindsay. Good question, and both questions, let me address them in turn. One, when you ask will it cost the state any money at all, there is some possibility, there are some lottery dollars through a lottery bond that was left over in an account through the Energy Efficiency and Sustainable Technology Act program that was allocated in the last biennium, which we may be able to use some of those dollars to help in consumer-owned utility territory. That would be a way to fulfill some of the pilot obligations from the bill that was passed in the last session. So technically that would be a state lottery fund, but we do not anticipate asking for any new funds other than what was already in that program from last session under the pilots that were authorized by that legislative session. Other than that, these are $1149 dollars are ratepayer dollars. They're not state dollars, and they're dollars that are already allocated to the school district. SELP dollars, as I mentioned before, are a loan and don't cost the state anything as part of that program. Your second question about clean energy and the school system, I think that there's very clearly a nexus there. And one of the things that Oregon is doing is has been very successful at leading the nation in an economic development strategy that's been based on clean energy. We've led the pack. We've managed to attract businesses like Solar World here to Oregon.
I think you're misinterpreting my question. I'm specifically asking about Section 2. It says Phase 2 is to promote the development of clean energy. I'm wondering whether that is within the scope of K through 12 as Phase 1 is. Phase 1 is K through 12. Phase 2 doesn't mention anything about K through 12.
Co-Chair Reed, Representative Lindsay, again, I'd reference that the bill is written in front of you as a shell that we intend to gut and stuff. The Phase 1 and Phase 2 concept is the idea is that one of the opportunities that we have with K through 12 schools is that we have a way to make an investment in infrastructure and in public infrastructure that reduces costs for Oregonians, but at the same time pilot some of the data that we discussed earlier in this work session that could then enable us to move out to other building types, whether that's other public building types or whether it's private sector building types, having that stream of data back to the utilities about how these measures perform and how we can best monetize those streams of benefit out of them could enable us to have a larger investment in clean energy. And so schools are a great way to pioneer and pilot that first step.
I want to make sure we have time for at least a couple people before we see Representative Greenlake. Barbara Byrd, Link Cannon, if you have a moment. Thank you guys very
Thank
much.
You.
And Mr. Endicott, would you like to be heard as well? We may not get to you. I'm just he is going to show up here in a couple of minutes, and then will be time for us to vacate. But Ms. Burt, if you want to get us started, please.
Yes, thank you. Co-Chair Reed, Co-Chair Bench, and members of the committee, my name is Barbara Bird. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO, which represents 225,000 members and working America members here in the state, and many of whom work in public schools, many more of whom do who help build and maintain those school facilities. The Oregon AFL-CIO is pleased to be part of the process of moving this bill. We've heard specifically concerns that the committee has about the timing of the program. There are few organizations more concerned than we are about the need to create jobs quickly. We face unemployment of 30% to 50% in our among our construction trades members, as you've heard before. But we firmly believe that the strategy that's being proposed by bill sponsors will allow the work to be carried out on a broad scale by this summer and will also enable the longer-term approach that you heard Rep. Bailey talking about earlier to expand this work in future years. We also believe that moving forward there are important labor and community standards that can be included in this bill. Not only can we create jobs across the state and put people to work as soon as possible, but these jobs can be good family wage jobs. We can encourage the employment of contractors who are willing to abide by strong standards for quality work as well as worker rights. And the bill can encourage economic development in local communities through its local hire provisions and by promoting opportunities for underrepresented workers in those communities by encouraging training and hiring of those folks. The Oregon AFL-CIO is pledged to work with you and your colleagues to assure the passage of this legislation to create jobs in Oregon now and in the future to strengthen our economy. We have a number of partners and members here today to testify on this bill. I hope that some of them will be able to do that. I can answer questions now or after they finish. Thank you.
Let's give them a chance to be heard, and then we'll see if we have any time left. Mr. Cannon.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, Co-Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Link Cannon. I'm here representing the Oregon Forest Industries Council. OFIC is an association of 50 large forest landowners and forest product manufacturing firms in the state who are pioneers in renewable energy in Oregon, and we strongly support continuing expansion of renewable energy opportunities in the state. My testimony that I've provided you with is relative to the dash one, so I'm obviously a little unclear as to exactly what we're working from, but we did have the dash one amendments from February 22nd, and my testimony speaks specifically to the provisions of that set of amendments. They contain section 4.2b of that amendment set requires DOE to consider factors for funding for high-performance schools pilot program, which include the incorporation of biomass to generate on-site electricity and heat at school district facilities. This is a provision that was included in the governor's forest health and biomass energy transition team recommendations for immediate actions to establish and maintain a market for biomass and create jobs in the short term. So that report focused on a number of things, and this is one of the short-term things that they identified that would be useful. I could talk at some length about the benefits of biomass.
Maybe not today.
In the interest of time, Mr. Chair, I'll tell you what the attachments are, and I hope you would have time to read them, and I'd love to have the time to go through them with you, but not today. The first is all three of these attachments are from an outfit called the Business Energy Resource Center, Biomass Energy Resource Center, excuse me, and they are kind of the premier sort of research group in America. They're located in Vermont in working on biomass research, and they do a lot of case studies and that kind of thing. So I've included three things from them that are probably more elegant than anything I could have produced. The first is a one-pager that talks about the benefits of using wood chip heating for schools and communities. And I think schools is a part of this. But as we move down this road, I think district heating, opportunities at for other public buildings, you know, you've talked about the nexus of schools and energy. I think this is a starting place, but I think there's a huge potential in Oregon to not only do this in schools, but a lot of other places. The second piece of it is economic case study. It's a comparison of fuel costs of various types of fuels and break even. Looking at different types of fuels. I would refer you to one graph in there. You were talking about price, the price of energy. It would be this one. If you're concerned with rising energy prices in the future, the red line on here is oil prices, and the blue line is biomass or wood price for energy. So this is one way, using biomass in schools is one way to insulate for heating and electricity.
Here comes, here's Representative Greenlick.
One way to get at that. And finally, there's another piece there about case
Larry.
Studies. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kent. Mr. Hancock, sorry to put you in that spot, but about 30 seconds.
You've got it, Co-Chair Reed and Co-Chair Benz. Just to reiterate, John Endicott, President of Oregon State Building and Construction Trades, we're ready to go. We have a highly skilled workforce. We're doing similar projects right now in the Portland Public Schools, which have been very successful. Attended the job rally today. About half of those members out there were building and construction trade workers that are ready to go to work. They're on the first string. They're standing on the sidelines, and they're waiting for you to say, Coach, put me in. So we're ready. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Endicott. Thank you all very much. Certainly, likely, we'll see this bill again. Appreciate the update, Representative Bailey, and all the good discussion. Given all the notifications we need to on
paper today.
Yes, okay. We'll close public hearing on House Bill 2960, or the work session on House Bill 2960. And if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we'll adjourn. Thank you very much.
From 1 to 3 in the
other.
Yeah. 4:30.